Even with Congress's failure to officially repeal the Affordable Care Act, our healthcare system is desperately broken. No proposed reforms have addressed the fact that the cost of medical care in the United States has grown far beyond what most people can afford, and pharmaceutical giant CVS's recent acquisition of Aetna only underscores what Americans have known for years. Our healthcare system is now in the money-making business, and perhaps not the healing one. As a Harvard-trained medical doctor and a veteran journalist, first with the New York Times, now as editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal has witnessed firsthand how healthcare has become a business. Her new book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Rosenthal to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. You were on when this book was originally out. It is now out in paperback. It has a new afterword. What has changed since the last time we talked? I mean, obviously, we have not been able to the attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act failed, and the healthcare system now just seems like we're gonna, I don't know, let it squirm and die, or. I don't even know where we are. How do you describe this period?
In near terminal, or, you know, we're muddling through, and that's not a good thing with something that accounts for nearly 20% of our economy and where patient lives are literally at stake. And I think, you know, we've watched in the last year this endless debate about, you know, trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and is it good, is it bad, is it, you know, beautiful, ugly. The truth is that the kind of pricing issues that this book deals with and that I'm really concerned about now are really beside the point when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. I mean, the Affordable Care Act did a lot of things, like it gave people insurance who had pre-existing conditions. It protected us with those lifetime caps on what insurers reimburse. But it didn't deal with this problem that is so widely acknowledged, that we just pay too much for everything in the United States, you know, multiples more than people pay for the same exact procedures or drugs or doctor's visit as anywhere else in the developed world. And none of us can afford it individually or as a nation if we keep spending this way and not getting any better results. I mean, you might be able to say, well, it's worth it if we saw that health results were better in the U.S. than in other countries. But in fact, we see the exact opposite. Our system is very expensive, very fragmented, delivers care that's motivated and driven by business concerns rather than what's good for patients. And that's a terrible place to be in.
So it seems to me, and my apologies if this is a spoiler alert and I'm giving away the ending to the book, but all of this basically boils down to greed, correct?
Yes. I mean, businesses are supposed to be greedy, right? That's what they do. That's the point of for-profit businesses. The problem is that we've entrusted our healthcare system to those businesses. And so there are lots of really, really wonderful physicians in the healthcare system. There are lots of great researchers in the healthcare system. But we've kind of handed over our healthcare system to commercial interests. And what are commercial values? Their return on investment, their profit, their efficiency. Well, that's not a healthcare value, really. I mean, yes, you want healthcare to be efficient, and it hasn't always been that way. When I became a doctor in the 80s, it was really inefficient. But, you know, front and center in healthcare should be caring, healing, talking, listening, and that's on the back burner now. What we see in our everyday healthcare and why doctors and patients hate it so much is that it's really driven by the finances. Is this going to make money or not? And the finances are largely now even removed from medicine. They're consultants, they're venture capital firms. their banks. You know, it's a huge, huge business. And in some ways, we're just kind of the widgets moving through it, unfortunately. But this is our healthcare.
I've been dealing with a medical emergency in my family here for the last couple of weeks. And the thing that has surprised me, and I mean, you just mentioned it, but it surprised me, is just how vocal doctors have become. And I mean, obviously, your doctor may vary. But the doctors are very, very, at least outspoken to me about the problems, their concerns, and even offering advice as to what we as consumers can do about it. If anything, is that not promising in some way?
Yes, I think there are a lot of promising voices that are beginning to be heard on the horizon, that as this was unraveling, as you know, what I tried to do in the book is to trace how healthcare became, moved from being a system that was about caring and healing and medicine to a system driven by finances in the last 25 years. I say how business hijacked our healthcare. And while that was happening, it happened in slow, small steps. So many in the medical profession, you know, they didn't go into medicine to think about business. They wanted to heal patients. They wanted to do surgery. So they didn't really push back. We as patients, because our insurer was mostly taking care of those costs at the time, didn't really notice it. And then suddenly, you know, when we see the high deductible plans and the doctors are in front of screens checking off billing lists, you know, we're like, whoa, how did this happen? We don't like this. And so we are seeing more of a protest from doctors becoming very active and saying things like, I'm not going to prescribe that cancer drug because it doesn't work and it's really expensive. Patients saying, you know, sending me their bills for a $17,000 urine test because they're so pissed off. And likewise, state legislatures passing surprise billing laws to protect patients, passing laws to limit pharmaceutical price increases, or as we see in Utah, you know, Utah, a Republican state, trying to allow consumers to be able to import drugs from Canada for less. We're seeing a lot of activity, not much of it in Washington, but there's a sense of we're at a tipping point and we got to do something now.
You talk about this in the book, and I think it's interesting, which is, Who should we be mad at? Who are the bad guys? If we're wearing the white hats, who's wearing the black hats?
Well, I think that we all want a villain, right? We all want to be able to say, oh, it's the pharma, those pharma bad guys and their lobbyists, or it's the insurers and their consolidation, or my local hospital. In fact, it's everyone. You know, we really, it's the way the system was designed. The system we work with now is designed to be an efficient money-making system. You know, one healthcare consultant called it somewhat unkindly, but if you're looking at it as a businessman, an extractive system, you know, like mining, where we're what's being, our health is what's being mined. And I think we're all, there have been some sectors that are more active than others in pushing the envelope to the kind of outrage we see today. Of course, pharma. Is you know, people like Martin Shkreli, and I tell you there are many Martin Shkrelis within the generic drug industry. He's not the only one. Yes, they're bad guys. There are also insurers who, you know, we see the premiums going up and we go, wow, did they really need to do that? What's the game here? But also, I think we need to look at ourselves as patients as well and say, how can we push back more? How can we make our voices heard? And why do we accept this? And so one little example is, you know, I have friends who go into hospitals and go, wow, I love that hospital. You know, there's such great art on the walls. And, you know, I always get a private room. And you know, there's this beautiful fountain in the lobby. And I always say, you know what? Don't love a hospital for that, because that's why our healthcare is so expensive, because our hospitals look like 7-star hotels. But they're not spending their money on health care. So we've been fooled a little bit, too. We've had the wool pulled over our eyes. And so that's part of why I want, you know, I wanted to expose for people where the value is in healthcare and where we should be looking, what we should care about. And it's not, you know, Calvin Klein design gowns and you know, thousand count bed sheets. It's what's the quality of my healthcare? Do I really need that MRI? Is this cancer drug that I've seen advertised on TV really what's best for my care? Will it do what I want in my life and to help me with my illness? And we're not in a very good position to ask those questions at the moment, but we should start asking them and demanding much more.
Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is our guest this morning. The name of the new book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. It's just out in paperback. It has a new afterword. Let me ask you about what we were talking about this on our program earlier today, which is the results from Pennsylvania. The exit polling indicates, if you believe polling, if you the exit polling mm-hmm. indicates that the people the people who were out voting and why that district changed by 21, 22 points is a concern over health care. And this, yeah. I guess it shouldn't be a big shock, but that's the thing. That's the issue that people labeled. Now, people say that it's a referendum on Donald Trump. Okay. But still, it seems to be from in this district, in this snapshot, in this period of time, it seems to be healthcare. What do you think, A, that tells us, and B, is that a hopeful sign that maybe we will get our act together? And I, although I don't know, I've stopped believing hopeful signs, but help me out.
I do think it's a hopeful sign. You know, we're seeing this over and over again. What are people's voting issues? Prescription drug prices, health care costs. You know, we now know that from polling that 20% of people with health insurance say they can't afford their medical bills. That's a really worrisome number. We know that I hear from people who are now spending 20 to 30% of their household income on health care. That's more than they're spending on housing, on food. You know, that's unsustainable. It's unbearable. Health care for Americans is a pocketbook issue. It's not, you know, it really affects family finances. You can't send your kid to summer camp. You can't afford your to change jobs. It's really a prison that we all live in a way. So I do think it's a voting issue and could be a much more potent one. I think a state that brings down prescription drug costs, that allows its citizens, for example, to import to reduce their drug prices, I think that would be heroic, and I think a politician that champions that would get votes. I mean, in Maryland, where they just passed a drug pricing bill, what they found in polling is that whatever party did that one thing, brought down drug prices, would win votes from Republicans who would cross over for Democrats and vice versa. So it is a winner if you're a local politician. Now, the thing I wonder is, why don't we see more of our politicians talking about this other than, oh, I'm for or against the Affordable Care Act? You know, that really wasn't a pocketbook act. That was to try and help people who didn't have insurance get insurance. But no one, and I forgive me if I haven't heard it, but that wasn't even a big platform issue in this race in Pennsylvania. I want to see politicians say, this is what I'm going to do about drug pricing, because we know there are things that can be done. And I bet that's a winning issue, but you know, for politicians to do that, they'll have to turn off their ears to the lobbying, which they're hearing plenty about right now from pharma that says, you know, we need these drugs. We spend a lot of money developing them. You can't control pricing. So I think, you know, our politicians, particularly nationally, but also at the state level, are hearing two different things. They're hearing one thing from the constituents, which is we can't afford these prices. And they're hearing another from the lobbying groups for pharma, for hospitals, for insurers saying, we need to pay more. We need to spend more. It's your health. So I want them to listen to patients and tell us what they're going to do. I hope in the 2018 races we see this becoming not just an issue of, you know, which both parties have said, yeah, drug prices are too high. Republicans, Democrats in Washington, the president has said it. Okay, fine. We know that. You know, we can't afford them. So what are you going to do about it?
I think the point you're making is fascinating, because there is that debate certainly is lacking, and it's easy to say, you know, that I'm for this or I'm against it, but what are you going to do about it? The thing that you said is there are things you can do about it, because I was under the impression it just doesn't seem like anybody knows what to do. So you're saying they know what to do, they just don't want to do it because they don't want to get, they don't want to, well, to use your term, piss off the lobbyists.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know what the end point is. The problem is there are different roads to getting there. So many of them are supported in a bipartisan way. I mean, Senators McCain and Klobuchar have proposed a bill that would allow for prescription drug imports from Canada, as an example. That bill has gone nowhere. But that is a bipartisan bill, right? You could also, and that's one route to allow imports, as we do for, you know, cars, refrigerators, salmon, you know, any everything.
Right.
And to do it in a controlled way, so we're not subjecting Americans to the vagaries of counterfeit drugs. We could also say, as every other developed country does, we're going to, in some fashion, negotiate drug prices at a large scale level. So the simplest way to do that in the U.S. would be to let Medicare negotiate drug prices for the U.S. for its beneficiaries. Now, there is, and that has some support in Congress, too. There have been bills to allow that. And again, President Obama suggested that. Hillary Clinton suggested that when she was running. There's a lot of support for that. There is some concern that, you know, if Medicare negotiates prices for its beneficiaries, pharma, which is endlessly agile, could raise prices for those of us who have commercial insurance. Although, you know, that I think most people feel won't happen, that commercial insurers could say, okay, we're going to pay what Medicare pays plus 10%, but we're not going to pay more. I mean, there are ways around that. But again, two very different routes to, or we could do something called reference pricing, which some countries do, which is to say, we're going to take a basket of other countries that are kind of like us, and we'll pay what they pay for prescription drugs. There are solutions. And one of them, which the Trump administration has proposed, is allowing faster advent of generics to the U.S. market. The problem is, which in theory sounds good, you know, generic medicines traditionally lower prices. What we've seen in recent years is drug companies can raise and have raised generic drug prices for many drugs to skyrocketing rates, 100%, 1,000%. So generics aren't necessarily cheaper anymore. If one company has a monopoly on making a generic, or if two companies share it, they can raise prices to whatever the market will bear, and it will often bear a lot. So again, there are a bunch of different kinds of solutions. All of them have a downside, but again, if we're letting the perfect be the enemy of the excellent in these cases, or our political divisions, you know, be the enemy of just getting something done. I think I say in the book, you know, there are lots of choices, and we're choosing option D, which is none of the above, and that doesn't work.
One of the most fascinating elements of the book is you talk about how we got here. And I, in the few moments that we have left, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, give us a sense of when things started to go wrong, question number one. Question number two, did we ever have it fully right?
No, I mean, is there a fully right in healthcare? This is part of where the perfect and the excellent come into play. I think, you know, every system struggles with new treatments, more expensive treatments, better technology. How do we hand out this? How do we appropriately use this technology? So it's always going to be a struggle. When did the commercial forces start coming in? I would say, and part of why I felt like I was in a good position to write this book was I trained in the 1980s, in the late 80s, practiced in the early 90s, And the forces were kind of moving in around then. When I worked in an emergency room, I was on a salary. People who came to the emergency room just got one bill. You know, it was an all-in bill. Now, as we've seen the commercialization of healthcare, what does an ER bill look like, right? That same visit, there's a fee, a facility fee for the ER, a fee for the doctor, for the ER doctor who may or may not be in your insurance network, a fee for the x-ray you got, a fee for the doctor who read the x-ray, a fee for the suture tray that was used to sew up your cut. You know, it's billed the way airplane tickets and cable bills are, you know, unbundled. And that's an outgrowth of the commercialization, because that's the way you maximize revenue, is by charging and charging a lot for each aspect of care. And that's what all of our hospitals do today.
So we have 2 minutes left. Let's end on a positive note. Where does your optimism lie?
Well,
assuming you have some.
No, I do have a lot of optimism. I think we are at a tipping point where there is a sense of outrage among physicians and patients, where they're standing up and saying, this is not okay for us anymore. Employers who've been paying through the nose for our insurance and often have great negotiating power are saying, enough. I mean, we look at the recent merger of Amazon, the healthcare project that Amazon and J.P. Morgan Chase and Berkshire Hathaway have proposed. You know, why did they do that? They'll probably in the end have a business product, but also it's because they're being killed by employee health expenses, and they know as business people that they're getting a bad deal. But I also think there's a lot we can all do individually, and we should do right away, because it will save us money and it will send signals to this crazy broken system. For example, like when I go to a doctor's office now and my doctor says, you need an x-ray, I say to him, fine, I'll get an x-ray, but tell me why I'm having it and send me to the most the cheapest center near your office that does a good job. Now, he doesn't know that the first time I ask, but the third time I ask, he'll know to send me to the one that's charging $200 for my x-ray rather than $2,000. And he may even say to the one that's charging $2,000, I'm not referring patients to you anymore because you're ripping them off. And that's the kind of cost consciousness that has been totally absent from our system and is now being infused into it. I hear from young doctors, you know, we always hear no one will go into medicine if there's not so much money. The medical schools are bursting at the seams with enthusiastic young doctors who say to me, I want prices on those order sheets so I know if I'm being wasteful. You know, I want to know what my hospital charges for an MRI. And if they're charging too much, I want to be able to march in there with all of my fellow residents and say, you know, knock it out, knock it off. This is about health, not about business. So I do see incredible passion and movement to moving us in the right direction. And I think every single patient can be part of that in pushing back and asking to see those bills from the hospital, in saying, as you do when you go to a restaurant, I want to see it itemized. And looking at the itemized bill and saying, as you would at a restaurant, hey, I never ordered that glass of wine. You know, I have one patient in the book who got a bill for a circumcision for his son when his son was never circumcised. You know, that should be fraud. And, you know, now the answer is, oh, yes, sorry. Sorry you caught us, right?
Right.
But we should all start doing that.
Well, the name of the book is An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.